we are in Boston at the Sheraton. The meeting is One Mind for Research, full title, Next Frontier of the Brain Forum, Imagining the Next Decade of Neuroscience Research and Development. The symposium number 3 was on the genetic revolution, and it was led, chaired by Robert Horwitz, who's with us now. Bob, welcome. What was your sense of the progress that's going on in terms of understanding genetic basis of neurobiological afflictions?
Well, I think we can start, in fact, by looking backwards a little bit to the history. If one looks at the foundations of the current genetic revolution, much of those foundations were laid by genetic studies of neuromuscular diseases. Duchenne's muscular dystrophy, Huntington's disease, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or Lou Gehrig's disease, all of these basically underscored how one could identify a Mendelian disorder and go from the genetics basically to the gene itself, and then use that gene as the basis for further understanding. What we are looking at today, in the context of what was the title of this session, the genetic revolution, mm-hmm. is vastly improved technologies and vastly increased opportunities for biomedical science in general and neuroscience in particular. And they come in part, and of course much of the symposium with which I was just involved is focused on it, on the advances in DNA sequencing. When we look at the increased rate and decreased cost, it means that there are things that can be done using sequencing that literally were unimaginable only a few years ago. So what we can see then is that there are opportunities to study basic aspects of the genetics of human neurologic and neuropsychiatric disease with the prospect of trying to use that understanding to drive biological understanding first and then therapeutics second. For example, as one is able to identify a series of genes involved in a complicated disorder, it is emerging, something very recent now, that those genes in fact can be put into baskets that are biological baskets of pathways and networks of genes involved in particular biological processes. And so that immediately directs your attention to specific areas of interest to study in the context of a disease that heretofore had been completely mysterious. So we're beginning to see clues like that in disorders like autism. We have data that we've just heard about that are emerging that say maybe we're going to get there with schizophrenia before long. And all of this, again, says, basically, I think we're poised. I think we're poised for discovery, and discovery in an area that I must say intellectually is, I think, the most intriguing that we have in the biological sciences, the brain. How does the brain form? How does the brain work? And what goes wrong in disorders of the brain?
One of the other things that was quite clear is the brain obviously is always being described as the most complicated structure in the known universe, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So finding a genetic basis for some of the neurobiological diseases and so on, I mean, it sounds like a very tall order.
The brain clearly is complicated, but science looks at complicated problems that are often simplified by their answers. You look at the universe, you look in the biological sciences at genetics, and one historically was dealing with the unknown with no imaginable kinds of answers to the questions that were there. Genetics, I think at this point, has been resolved. We understand the mechanistic bases of heredity. Before that, in the biological sciences, the answer to the question, what is life? How do we have these molecules that basically drive the energy that can make the complex forms that generate life. What is life? What is heredity? We have answers to those first order today. What is the brain? Very complicated, but it may well be, as we learn more about it, there will be principles that emerge that allow us to think about that complexity in the context of these simple principles.
Yeah, I wasn't trying to be pessimistic here. It was just the question that, I mean, you got the 2002 Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine along with Sidney Brenner and John Sulston, right? Largely for work that you did on C. elegans, which was Sidney's model organism, which is known to a fairly well now. I mean, exactly how many genes and so on and so forth. So understanding, my point there was to make a comparison between saying there's a model organism that you can know a great deal about. You look at the brain and it's so enormously complicated that one wonders what kind of new technologies are going to be needed or what kind of collaborations between geneticists and people like Carl Dicerov, for example, or the fMRI people to actually be able to get a real handle on this?
Well, to have a comprehensive understanding of the brain, there are a huge number of cells and an even larger number of connections. But to understand the principles, and in particular to understand some of the driving factors in disease, is, I think, a simpler problem. Specifically for genetic disease, if you have a genetic disease, be it one gene or many genes, you know the root cause. So you can then say, here is the beginning of a pathway. And you can use that pathway to try to identify the subsequent players. Players in terms of genes, in terms of molecules, in terms of cells, and in terms of cell systems. And when you start talking about intervening, you want to understand not just the genetics, but you want to understand the neurobiology, but you can be directed to that neurobiology from the gene. So you get a focused effort rather than a nondescript, everything seems to be wrong, and you hope you can build up from the basics at the same time that some of the more global approaches, like you mentioned some of the brain imaging methods, are looking in a more global way. Mm-hmm. And by, again, quoting Sidney Brenner, if you go from the bottom up and the top down, you hope you're going to emerge in the middle with a picture of basically what is, how it works, and how it goes wrong.
So you're at MIT, though, right? And the McGovern Institute for Brain Research.
At MIT.
Right. So what's your current focus in terms of your own research?
My own research in the area of neuroscience is basically divided between aspects of development, how does an organism make a nervous system, and aspects of behavior. How does that nervous system work, respond to its environment, and respond to experience? My major focus at MIT has been and continues to be on the nematode worm C. elegans, and in that context, we're currently interested in such basic problems as how does a cell decide to become a neuron? How do you generate laterality in a nervous system? We know that much of the nervous system is left-right symmetric, but not quite. And we know that not quite makes a big difference. You hear the expression left brain, right brain. Mm-hmm. One of the problems we're working on now is how does an organism that basically develops with bilateral symmetry generate asymmetry in a developmental way. We're interested, and we've had a long-standing interest in the problem of programmed cell death or apoptosis, which in C. elegans is fundamentally a problem of nervous system development, and of course is fundamental to the development of our own nervous systems. So those are all aspects of development. At the same time, we're interested in aspects of behavior. We have studied behavioral plasticity in response to the environment. We've worked on the role of dopamine, a very important neurotransmitter and neuromodulator, in terms of controlling C. elegans movements and abnormalities in those movements that are consequences of deficiencies in dopamine function. And we are now studying what we believe is a novel player in synaptic transmission, the fundamental mechanism that nerve cells use to talk to each other. This mechanism has been studied by many people over the years, and I think we have now discovered a new player that is really key in that process. So broadly speaking, we're trying to understand a sweep of issues in terms of the development and the functioning of the nervous system. And having used that distinction, development and functioning, of course we have to remember that biology does not always follow the language that we may speak in. So the functioning of the nervous system, given that nervous systems are plastic, involve changes, and it turns out that many of those changes use the same mechanisms that are used in the development of the nervous system in the first place. So we study development, how it generates a nervous system, how the nervous system works, and how it changes, which brings us back to development and how those changes are made.
Which also goes directly into this program of this 10-year program. People are often interested in how people got to be doing the things that they're doing, what the trajectory was and so on. Do you remember when you first got interested in science or why you ended up doing science?
I think from a very young age, I was interested in issues of science, and certainly in high school I was very interested in math and science. I went to MIT as an undergraduate, expecting to major maybe in math or chemistry. I ended up majoring in two areas. I have degrees in mathematics and economics. And my route to biology was, I would say, unusual, except for the fact that many people have had equally unusual routes. It wasn't until my last year at university that I even took a biology course. And it was 6 weeks into that course I decided biology looked interesting. I went to the professor teaching the course, a marvelous scientist named Cy Leventhal, and I said, "Dr. Leventhal, I am a senior, I'm about to graduate, I'm really enjoying your course, and I'm thinking about applying to graduate school in biology. Am I crazy?" And he looked at me and he said, "My undergraduate degree was in physics, my PhD was in physics, and I'm teaching your course. You would be early."
But your parents didn't have any interest in obviously in your Nobel autobiography, the growing up in Chicago and so
right.
on, the parental influences sound very strong there. Yeah. And I also got the impression that you were almost a businessman at one point because you started magazines, didn't you?
I started a magazine, but the mark of a successful businessman is how much one makes. And what I made with that magazine was sufficient to convince me that maybe that wasn't the best route, at least at age 10. But indeed, my parents were categorically pivotal in many ways. My father, I think, had two real life ambitions. The first was to be a chemist. So he was very much interested in being a scientist. And the second, maybe it really was the first, was to be a catcher on a professional baseball team. Both of these aspirations failed because his eyes were not very good and his family was not wealthy enough to buy him a pair of glasses. So he couldn't really see very well. And it was only some years later that a teacher bought a pair of glasses for him and allowed him to continue with at least some of his studies. So he didn't go on with either chemistry or baseball, but I think the spirit of both lasted. My mother was a school teacher, and she was trained in and taught English, but then somehow advanced with me through the grades and began teaching science and actually took a course and got a master's degree in astronomy. And became very interested in you know, science in the elementary school. But I think more than the specifics, I think it was the nature of inquiry that I grew up with. Both of my parents raised me to ask why. to ask why, to ask how, and to have the self-confidence to go on and try to do something on my own.
There's a little book, I ask everybody this, there's a little book by Peter Medawar called Advice to a Young Scientist. Mm-hmm. I mean, following on what you just said and thinking about your own trajectory, and what would your advice be to the young scientists who are now under your tutelage?
My first advice would be follow your heart.
Yeah.
If your heart isn't in it, it won't work and you won't have fun. You want to have fun and you're going to do better doing something you like. My second piece of advice would be don't be afraid to change. Just in the same way that I went from math and economics into biology, it's actually never too late to do something different. Just follow your heart, do what you want to do, whatever it is you've done before, and do your best.
It also says here that during the summer of 1968, you were reading Jim Watson's autobiography, The Double Helix. Was that one of the things that made you think about wanting to go to, what led you to Cambridge eventually?
Well, the Double Helix I was reading just before I entered graduate school.
Yeah.
Okay, so I was about, in fact, to go to Jim Watson's department and ended up Jim Watson's student. Whether that book per se drove me to Cambridge, I don't know. Jim himself, I was informed at one point during my graduate career, had basically, I think, traded me to Stanford. Because there was a lot of exchange at that point between students at Harvard and Stanford and postdocs at reciprocally Stanford and Harvard. But I wanted to do something a little bit different from what was going on at Stanford and did end up going to Cambridge, where, of course, Jim had a very long, powerful history.
Yeah. So this is the point at which you met Sydney?
I did something that I would not recommend to any of my students or perhaps anybody else, and that is I went to Cambridge, England to work with Sidney Brenner, having never been in either Cambridge and never been in Cambridge, England, and never having met Sidney Brenner. It worked out fine, but I can't say that I properly did my homework.
So,
but I did have the philosophy if it didn't work, I would do something else.
Did you apply for it, or did you?
Oh yes.
Yeah, and
yes, I sent Sydney a letter, and I said, I'm interested in coming to work with you on this worm. What do you think about memory and learning? And Sydney wrote back and said, I have no idea if worms remember or learn. How do you feel about suppressor tRNAs? And we went on from there.
That's a very interesting story. In Cambridge, other people you're interacting with? You'd already left Harvard, and you'd been associated also with Matt Maselson, right? And
well, I was associated with Matt very early in my PhD
and
career.
And Wally Gilbert as well?
And Wally. So when I went to Harvard, I was initially associated with Matt's lab, but I moved soon thereafter to the lab that was jointly run by Jim Watson and Wally Gilbert and Klaus Weber. And that was a phenomenal experience because Jim has long had an incredible intuition from science. Wally is exceedingly critical as an experimental thinker and in finding flaws in experimental design. And Klaus Weber is a protein chemist who had magic fingers and could do things that nobody else could do. So being in an environment where you were being trained by and exposed to the thinking of these three spectacular scientists was an incredible experience.
And you've all got Nobel Prizes. Actually,
well,
that's an amazing collection.
I've been particularly lucky because If I look at my own trajectory, when I was an undergraduate, I wrote my undergraduate thesis in mathematical economics with Bob Solow,
who got a
Nobel Prize in economics. I then went to Harvard and worked first with Jim Watson, and then officially with Wally Gilbert after Jim moved to the Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory. And of course, Jim already had a Nobel Prize, and Wally subsequently got a Nobel Prize. I then moved to Cambridge, England, and worked under the direction of Sidney Brenner in collaboration with John Sulston. And of course, the three of us shared the Nobel Prize. So everybody I worked with got a Nobel Prize. I can say in most of those cases through no fault of my own. But the thing that continues to be remarkable to me beyond that statement is something that I realized the day that I heard that I had received the Nobel Prize. And that was, at that point, everybody I knew someone with a Nobel Prize.
Wow. Your work at Cambridge with Sidney, I mean, did anything particular stand out in your memories of that period?
The intellectual stimulation at the MRC Medical Research Council Laboratory of Molecular Biology was spectacular. People did science, and people thought about science, and people talked about science. You had morning coffee and you talked about science. You had lunch and you talked about science. You had afternoon tea and you talked about science. And with Sidney, it didn't stop there. So I can remember times when I was studying the worm cell lineage, and that means staring through a microscope hour after hour, waiting for cells to divide. And it would get later and later, and it might be 2 o'clock in the morning, and I would go in to get a cup of tea, completely exhausted, wanting nothing more than to finish and go home, and Sidney would hear the spoon in the coffee cup and come in to chat. And he would chat for half an hour, and go back and do whatever he was doing, and he would be back by 6 or 7 in the morning the next day. So there was a lot of talking, and the talking was very much focused on science, very broadly focused on science, and exceedingly stimulating and great fun.
Yeah. A question I like to ask people is about the relationship between science and society. When the administration came in, President Obama said that he would like to restore science to its rightful place. Without saying exactly what that was, do you have a sense yourself of what the rightful place of science is?
Well, let me say that I have recently become chairman of the board of an organization in Washington called Society for Science and the Public, or SSP. Okay. And SSP has as its mandate increasing the understanding of and appreciation of science by the public. And it has a variety of programs, and probably the most visible of these is that it has run for all the years since they have begun the science fairs that are now known as the Intel Science Fairs, previously the Westinghouse Science Fairs, and it also has published since the 1920s Science News. So that is a goal that I believe very, very strongly in. The public should be knowledgeable about science and should have an appreciation of what science is. Now that translates also to inside the Beltway and to members of Congress and to the White House, because of course the funding for particularly biomedical science in this country is very much government funding, mostly to the NIH, but also through a variety of other agencies. And that funding has to be mandated by the government. So those individuals who are involved have to understand, what is the science doing? Why is the science important? What is the importance of clinical research? What is the importance of translational research? What is the importance of basic research? How intermingled are these? And how do we decide how much is the right amount, and how do we decide how to allocate amongst different priorities? And to do that requires an understanding, and so I feel it is very important that scientists literally get out of any ivory tower and communicate both with the public and with the people in government who are responsible for making decisions. And I have to say a second involvement I've had, and I've had for well over 20 years now, is with an organization called the Coalition for Life Sciences, mm-hmm. which basically is a combination of scientific and biomedical societies that in Washington talks to people in Congress about the importance of biomedical research. It has helped with the Congressional Biomedical Caucus, which is one of the most successful caucuses that the Congress, in particular the House, holds, and it has been involved in many other ways in terms of promoting science inside the Beltway.
There's pitifully few scientists in elected in politics, though. I mean, there was an attempt to get, I've heard of an attempt to try and persuade more of them to run. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's a good plan, to have more scientists actually in the House?
I wouldn't say more scientists. I would say it depends on the scientist. Scientists have, like all people, differing talents. And there are some scientists who I think would do very well in a political setting, both because they could communicate what they understand and that they would have sufficient taste and ability to deal with the other, you know, great variety of problems they would have to confront. So I think it's if a scientifically trained person has the interest and the ability to do something well in the political arena, I think that's fantastic. But I don't think it would be the right step for many of the scientists, just as I don't think it would be the right step for many people who are not scientists. Hmm. But it would be great to have more people who really understand science in the Congress. There are a few.
If I gave you a time travel token and said you could bring anybody to your dinner table that anywhere, anytime in history, or is there anybody who's fascinated you that you'd really like, wish you could have had a one-on-one conversation with?
There are, of course, you know, the geniuses from past years, you know, Leonardo and others you can talk about. But I don't know if there is anybody specific I would rate particularly highly. I heard what I really thought was the best answer to that question just a few weeks ago, but the question was asked slightly differently, and the question was, if you could bring anybody back to talk to today, who would it be? And the answer that was given is exactly the answer I would give. It's my father.
Ah. What do you, having sat and listened through these sessions and so on, the work that you're doing now and so on, what are you optimistic about?
I'm optimistic about the opportunities. I really believe that biomedical science in general and neuroscience in particular is poised for enormous breakthroughs in science and therapeutics. What I'm less optimistic about is that given the current climate, that there will be sufficient resources to allow people to take advantage of those opportunities. And what I really hope is that it will be possible to communicate how key these opportunities are, how real these opportunities are, and how taking advantage of these opportunities will expand our intellectual understanding of ourselves and our world, and beyond that, have impact on our economy and on our health. And by our health, I mean the health of people in this country and the world. And I think those opportunities are all there, meaning that the investment that would be made would have such a great return that priorities ought to be such that that investment can be made even if some other things have to be compromised. And I think people would disagree, perhaps, about what other things should be compromised first, but I can't believe that given the drivers that we have today in neuroscience in particular, that people, if they understood, wouldn't want to take advantage of what's possible.
Well, Paul Ritz, thanks very much for talking to us.
Okay, well, thank you.